a few years ago, we got a cookbook, 30-minute meals from Jamie Oliver. So 30 minutes and you can have a full meal on the table. And subsequently, Jamie Oliver brought out another cookbook, 15-minute meals, even easier to get a meal on the table. I was wondering, is he going to bring out 5-minute meals? He hasn't. He's brought out 5-ingredient meals, just 5 ingredients. It's so simple. You get a meal on the table. What a recipe. What recipes they must be. But Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, one of my favorite cooks, he's gone one better. He has 3 simple things on a plate. And you're thinking, wow, this is really, really straightforward, really, really simple. It's amazing that some of these recipes can be reduced to such simplicity. In Judges 9, what we have is a very simple recipe. But what it is a recipe for disaster. A recipe where the wrong man gets into power and the consequences are tragic. Now, there's lots going on, as we've just seen, and yet what it boils down to is 2 simple ingredients, 2 basic ingredients. And what Judges chapter 9 does for us is by showing us this recipe for disaster, it enables us to avoid it. So if you've had disaster in your life as a whole in some areas, or if you want to avoid it in the future, this is vital for us to hear. How can we be saved from disaster, either in the past or in the future? So what is the recipe? Well, let's have a look. So what's the first ingredient? We see in verse 1, as we pick up what's going on in this story, Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal, went to his mother's brothers in Shechem and said something to them. So who's Abimelech? Abimelech is Jerubbaal's son. Who's Jerubbaal, you ask? Well, Jerubbaal is another name for Gideon. Gideon, as we see in verse 17, Gideon is a man who fought for the people of Israel, risked his life to rescue them from the hand of Midian, the hand of their enemy. So Gideon is one of these judges, one of these heroes, and Abimelech is his son. So who's Abimelech's mother? Well, it's not Gideon's wife, but it's Gideon's concubine, his slave girl, as it says later on in this chapter. And she's from Shechem. And Abimelech is from Shechem. And he's not one of the other 70 sons that Gideon has with his many wives. So that's the family tree. It's a little bit complex, a little bit complicated, but that's where Abimelech is from. And what Abimelech does is he goes to his home place, the homestead, and he speaks to the people of that place. In verse 2, he says, "Ask all the citizens of Shechem, which is better for you, to have all 70 of Jerubbaal or Gideon's sons rule over you, or just one man?" So he poses a question to them. Now, it is just a question. It's just a breath of wind being blown into their ears, really. It's just a suggestion. It's a question about rule, a question about kingship, a question about holding sway over people, about control. It's just a question. It's quite subtle, isn't it? It's quite indirect. He doesn't say, "I want to be your king. Vote for me." There was no mention of him wanting to be king. He doesn't say, "I'm going to commit mass murder," as we've seen later on in the chapter. No, he's just putting it out there. Which would be better for you? To have 70 of Gideon's sons, Jerubbaal's sons, reigning over you, or just one? Just one. We won't name him. Just one. Just floating the idea. What does he do when he puts this question to them? He appeals to a couple of things. He appeals to their self-interest, doesn't he? Isn't that interesting? Which is better for you? So he doesn't appeal to the truth, because if he appealed to the truth, he would be immediately undermined in his argument. He appeals to their self-interest. What's going to be better for you? And he appeals to loyalty. At the end of verse 2, "Remember, I am your flesh and blood. I'm your brother." And family ties can run deep, can't they? And sometimes that is a good thing. Commitment to family can be a good thing. But in this instance, What he's doing is he's using that loyalty, using that commitment to as a lever, as leverage, as guilt for them to do what he wants them to do. And that, believe it or not, is the first ingredient. Just a little question, a little suggestion, a little hint, and you're thinking, is that it? I remember being in India years ago, and a friend of mine had asked me to pick up some saffron for them. And I didn't know what saffron was. Your man behind the counter asked me, how much saffron would you like? I said, I don't know, like a kilogram? And he laughed at me. He said, you don't buy a kilogram of saffron. You buy like maybe three strands of saffron. Just a tiny little bit. And all this first ingredient is in this recipe for disaster is a tiny little question, a tiny little suggestion. And of course that happens sometimes in our life, doesn't it? All it takes is a question or a suggestion. 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, you're in work, you're working hard, you have the head down, and a friend, colleague comes along and they say, do you want to go out for a drink? Just a question, just a suggestion. You're thinking, oh, I know where this ended last time with this person, with this group. What did they do? Sometimes, well, you've been working hard all week, you deserve it. What are they doing? They're appealing to the self-interest. Not to the truth, not that you're supposed to be there till five. What's another appeal to loyalty? Oh, I thought I could depend on you to come for a drink with me. Do they care really who it is that goes with them? Not necessarily. And the next day you're wondering how you ended up with these regrets again. And sometimes it can help when we see something happening in our lives that we genuinely regret to work backwards through the chain of events and ask, where did it begin? Very often it begins with something that seems so subtle, so insignificant, so small. And yet to be able to spot that first ingredient can avert us from disaster. It's interesting, isn't it? You start to see it everywhere. I mean, some of the recent votes in politics, what have they been appealing to? Family loyalty. What if somebody in your family was in this situation? I mean, surely you have to vote this way as a result. What about the budget? It's self-interest. We're going to create a budget all around you and the 5 million other people who live in this country. Now, nothing wrong with self-interest or loyalty in their place, but if they come before a commitment to truth and right and wrong, it is the beginnings of a recipe for disaster. We're going to see how this unfolds, but just for now, we want to notice this, and we want to see where this may happen in our lives. Where there is disaster in the past, we can work backwards through it and see what had got the ball rolling and avoid it the next time. And you're thinking, well, it can't be as simple as that, can it? And it's not. There is one other ingredient in the recipe for disaster. And what is it? Well, let's have a look. Let's look at how this question begins to work on the people. So in verse 3, the brothers repeated all this to the citizens of Shechem. They were inclined to follow Abimelech. You see what's going on? Quite literally, it could be translated, their hearts were inclined to follow Abimelech. They're starting to lean now towards Abimelech. And what's the reason for them leaning in this way? He is related to us. You see what's happened? So he's put a little thought in their minds, I'm your flesh and blood, I'm your brother. And suddenly, they're leaning towards him with the very same reason in their mind. He's related to us. He's our brother. What's happened here? Abimelech, he is like a master musician who has loads of tuning forks laid out before him, and he finds exactly the right one to strike and to place on their heartstrings that will resonate with them. If he had said something otherwise, they may not have been tempted to listen to him. If you say to me, would you like to go for a cup of broccoli tomorrow? I'm not there. I'm not rocking the broccoli. But if you say to me, do you want to come for a cup of coffee? I'll be there. See, Abimelech knows what's going to resonate with their hearts. And this is the second ingredient, the heart dynamic that's going on here. It's not enough to have the subtle question, the little suggestion. It's the one that responds or resonates with something in us that resonates with those desires within us. Why is it that this resonates with him? He's related to us. He's our brother. Well, I mean, there's a lot of potholes in Shechem at the moment. And if our man is in power, he's going to look after us, isn't he? He's going to look out for us. He'll get it sorted. Our man Abimelech. So this little suggestion, little question, it works on their hearts. And then that flows out into their actions. Verse 4, they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-Berith. And Abimelech used it to hire reckless scoundrels who became his followers. So the money now is right. 70 pieces of silver. Clink, 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 clink. 70 pieces counted out, maybe into a bag or something. And maybe with each one of them, they are having to remind themselves why they are paying this price. Because he's our brother. He's our brother. He's our brother. He's our brother. That makes sense, doesn't it? That we would do this because he's our brother. And maybe as Abimelech counts the money later on to check it. 70 pieces of silver, clink, clink, clink. I wonder, was he thinking, 70 pieces of silver, 70 brothers, one for each man's life. And with each clink, was he thinking, it's my brother, it's my brother, it's my brother. I mean, what should have been so obvious to these people was that here is a man who appeals to the fact that they are his brothers, for them to put him into power over them. And yet here is a man who is willing to kill his brothers, literally his brothers, his blood brothers, in order to be king over them. What makes them think that he will act any different towards them? How could it possibly be better that this guy holds sway over our lives? And yet what has happened? The appeal to self-interest, the appeal to loyalty, guilt, loyalty has clouded their vision so they cannot see. Mark Twain, he says, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. Abimelech and the men of Shechem, what are they thinking? Never let the truth get in the way of self-interest. And Abimelech moves quickly. He hires reckless scoundrels, verse 4, who become his followers. Not just any men, but reckless men. These are the right men for this kind of job, aren't they? The type of men who will not let the truth get in the way of a tidy prophet. And he goes, in verse 5, to his father's home in Ophrah, and on one stone murders his 70 brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal. Why were they all there at that time? Who knows? The moment is right, though. The money is right. The men are right. The moment is right for this tragic murder. They're literally sacrificed on the altar of Abimelech's self-promotion and on the altar of these men's self-interest. They are left in his wake as he strives for the top. How different he is to Jesus. How different Jesus is to him. What happened when some people tried to make Jesus king? Tried to force him to be king out of their own self-interests. He refused. He would not be king just to serve their needs. He would not be a king who would just be a pawn, a political power play on their part. How different Abimelech is to Jesus. Jesus who doesn't put his enemies to death but dies for them. If you're a believer this evening, it was when we were God's enemies that Christ died for us. And what began as this little breath of wind, little suggestion, little question blowing across their hearts ends with awfully tragic consequences. Some of us are thinking, well, I'm glad this kind of thing doesn't happen anymore. I mean, this is the Old Testament. It's so horrific and horrendous and awful that somebody would have murder committed for a few pieces of silver for just to get into a position of power or honor. I heard recently from a former Garda detective, a policeman, detective, and he'd worked in Dublin for 30 years, and he recently said this, he worked with against gangland crime. He said the big change over those 30 years is the number of men who now would be willing to murder for money. This is in Dublin. He says you'd a handful of them only 20 years ago, and now young fellas in our city see it as a badge of honour to kill someone. He says they do it to earn their way into the world. And you wonder, how does this happen? I was chatting to another guard recently. This isn't anything to reflect on what I've been up to, but just happened to be chatting to another guard recently. And he explained to me how people get into this situation. As children, they will be targeted by these criminals, and they'll be offered, here's a nice new pair of runners if you'll just do this little job for me, this little errand for me. Of course, what child would say no to a nice new pair of runners? The child's heart, the child's self-interest. Within a few years, they've pledged loyalty to this group of people, this group of men. And not long after that, they're willing to kill for money. I mean, it happens in our own city where this recipe for disaster occurs. And it can happen in different ways in our own lives, can't it? It can have devastating consequences if we are not aware, first of all, of how subtle it can be when it begins in our lives, just a suggestion, just a question. And if we're not aware of what is going on in our own hearts and guarding ourselves against it. I mean, this is why the author of the Proverbs says things like this. Now, O sons, listen to me. Do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from the adulterous woman and do not go near the door of her house. Lest at the end of your life you groan when your flesh and body are consumed. It can be absolutely disastrous. Just a small suggestion working on our heartstrings. It's disastrous for Abimelech and the people, and yet it doesn't seem like that for them. Maybe that's the reality of living in a survival of the fittest world, is it? I mean, in verse 6, all the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo gathered beside the great tree at the pillar in Shechem to crown Abimelech king. I mean, it's wonderful, isn't it? Now we have a new king. I mean, yeah, the end justifies the means, really, doesn't it? I mean, we have peace. It's one man. He's uniting the country. Isn't this wonderful? This isn't disastrous. I mean, this is clarity. We know where we're headed under Abimelech. Maybe it's better that he does rule over us, as he had suggested, as he had put the question to us. What is the problem exactly? Well, a young man called Jotham in verse 7 starts to outline the problem. When Jotham was told about this, he climbed up on the top of Mount Gerizim and shouted to them. Who's Jotham? He's the guy who had escaped in verse 5. Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal. He had escaped by hiding. He hadn't been killed. He's the youngest. He escapes. He is a remarkable man. He is the only voice in this place who is willing to speak the truth, who sees clearly the truth of the situation. And he is unafraid in this moment to stand on a mountaintop and shout the truth to them. What a man. And he begins to tell a story in verse 8. One day the trees went out to anoint a king for themselves. They said to the olive tree, be our king. But the olive tree answered, "Should I give up my oil, by which both gods and humans are honored, to hold sway over the trees?" Next, the tree said to the fig tree, "Come and be our king." But the fig tree replied, "Should I give up my fruit, so good and sweet, to hold sway over the trees?" Then the tree said to the vine, "Come and be our king." But the vine answered, "Should I give up my wine, which cheers both gods and men and humans, to hold sway over the trees?" The trees asks the fig tree, the olive tree, the vine, "Rule over us." And each one of them says, "No, it is not right. I have my place. I have my God-given role, which brings pleasure to man and to God. And I will not take this role in your life." Do we recognize that? If we are the trees, do we recognize that actually there are some people, there are some things that we need to say, "No, they should not take this role in my life, that they hold sway over me like this. Should I give up my fruit to hold sway over the trees?" The answer is no, absolutely not. They realize it's not their place. But look at what happens in verse 14 and 15. "Finally, all the trees said to the thorn bush, 'Come and be our king.' The thorn bush said to the trees, 'If you really want to anoint me king,'" or translated otherwise, "if it's in good faith that you're anointing me king, 'come and take refuge in my shade.'" Now, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the other three, the olive, the fig, and the vine, they all say, "I have a role, I have fruit to bear, I have oil to create." The thorn bush, the bramble, has nothing. Nothing to leave, nothing to lose. Maybe it's not wrong of the thorn bush to take on this role. But even the thorn bush in this story knows that if the motives are wrong in the people asking this, in the trees asking this, the results will be disastrous. You'll be consumed by fire. We've seen the fires raging, haven't we, through Australia, through parts of California. Verse 15, "If not, then let fire come out of the thorn bush and consume the cedars of Lebanon." So what's Jotham doing here in telling this story? What's he focusing on? He's not only focusing on the facts of the events, but he's starting to focus on their hearts. The motives in all this. Why have you asked for this king, trees? Now, he's going to tell us very clearly the facts of it in a moment. But just let's take notice of how he's going about this. I mean, he's telling a story to these people. Now, if ever there was a time for somebody to be direct and blunt and to the point, this is it. His 70 brothers have been murdered. And yet he begins with a story about trees. Why does he do that? Is it because he's afraid? No, he's not afraid. He wants to make it as clear as possible to them. He's going to get to the meaning in a moment. But he wants them to realize very, very clearly the truth of it. And in fact, the best way for him to do that is to show them these trees over here, before they can see what's right in front of them. Their vision has been so clouded by self-interest, by loyalty, that they cannot see what's straight in front of them. And so Jotham says, "Look at these trees, so that I can then show you this straight in front of you." Is that it from Jotham? No, not at all. He makes it clear so that they are left in no doubt. In verse 16, he starts to speak to them. You can have it as kind of rhetorical questions, depending on how you work with some of the punctuation. "Have you acted honorably and in good faith by making Abimelech king? Have you been fair to Jerubbaal and his family? Have you treated him as he deserves?" I mean, they're rhetorical questions, but they are statements, really, aren't they? Of course you haven't. Isn't it interesting? Jotham has told the story. Now he's confronting them with the facts, literally. Some of us might be tempted to just tell the story and never actually explain what we mean by it. Others of us might be tempted to just go straight in with the facts. And people cannot understand what we're saying. We need the ability to bring a story first, so that they cannot deny the truth of what we're saying. Jotham does both. He lays out the facts for them now. Verse 17, my father fought for you, risked his life for you, rescued you from the hand of Midian. But today you have revolted against my father's family. You've murdered his 70 sons on a single stone and have made Abimelech, the son of his female slave, king over the citizens of Shechem because he's related to you. This is what you've done. This is the reality. And there's really only two roads now out of this town. Verse 19, if you've acted honorably, may Abimelech be your joy and may you be his too. Hypothetically, even though I've just laid out my case that this is absolutely not true, but hypothetically, if you have acted honorably, let you have joy in this new king of yours and let him have joy in you. But if you have not, and I think Jotham has made it pretty clear that they have not, if you have not, then let fire come out from Abimelech and consume you. And let fire come out from you and consume Abimelech. He's told the story, he's applied the logic, he's made it abundantly clear. And isn't it interesting? Sometimes people will not hear us because we haven't explained what we're trying to say very clearly. Sometimes people won't hear us because we've gone in too forcibly with our arguments, like a bull in a china shop, and they cannot see what's straight in front of them as a result. But sometimes we do all that we can by God's grace to explain as carefully as we can, as creatively as we can, as clearly as we can, and they still don't like it. They still don't want to hear it. And sometimes that's us, isn't it? Sometimes as God's word is preached, sometimes as we read his word, we don't want to hear it. But what Jotham says to them is, you've created a disaster here. It's disastrous for you. It's going to be disastrous for Abimelech. And it's amazing. It's amazing as he paints this bleak, dark picture. He says to them in verse 7 at the very outset, listen to me so that God may listen to you. There is still a glimmer of hope if you will just please hear what's being said. And this is the glimmer of hope. If you're a believer this evening, this is the glimmer of hope that you have clung on to listen to God, to listen to our need to turn back to him. Even if we have made a disaster of our lives, isn't that the extraordinary thing that Jesus comes to us in the gospel? He says, turn back to me. Allow me to rule over you. Unlike the olive, the fig, the vine, this is his rightful place in our lives, to rule over us, that we might live in his good ways, that we might think according to his truth, that we might love because he first loved us. How do we come to Jesus? How do we allow him to rule over us? How do we invite him to rule over us? We do it in good faith and with integrity, as Jotham hints at here. What does it mean to come to Jesus in good faith and with integrity? It means to acknowledge where we have gone wrong, to acknowledge that we have allowed people and things to hold sway over us. In that part of our lives that we call before being a Christian, but even as a Christian, where we go through periods of time where we allow others to hold sway over us, like the trees wanted. Be our king, we say. When we come to Jesus like that, what is the amazing result? Verse 19, if you have, may Abimelech be your joy and may you be his too. If these people, even now after murdering the 70 brothers, if they can come and find joy in Abimelech hypothetically, how much more do we find joy in Jesus, our Savior? As we come to him, as we acknowledge again to him where we have gone wrong, we find joy in him because he forgives us. We find joy in him because we reflect on the disasters in our lives, and somehow he works even those for our good. And it is breathtaking to hear that and to realize that. And yet that is the joy that we have this evening. Because Jesus, like one author puts it, is like this doctor who has come to heal us. And there is nothing that brings us greater joy than being healed by him. When we have realized our sickness, realized he is the specialist in forgiving us, realized he is the only one who can bring healing to us, and not only can he just bring healing to us, the brokenness in us, but that he will one day make us perfectly new. Not only do we find joy in Jesus as the doctor who heals us, he finds joy in us, as any good doctor does when they give themselves to the healing of those who come to them. What a joy to come to him again and again, this one who it is his right and his good rule over us in our lives. To say to him again and again, forgive me, I've allowed this to hold sway. I've allowed this person to hold sway. Forgive me, I've allowed my anger to hold sway, my lust to hold sway, my envy to hold sway. Forgive me, Jesus. He rejoices in healing us, making us more like himself. What we have in this chapter is a recipe for disaster, and yet what we have in this chapter is a little glimmer, a little pointer to our great Savior Jesus, who rescues us from disaster, both in the past, in the present, and in the future.